Yeah, so we have agenda paper 5 that discusses submission about how to account for cash flows of an insurance contract issued and of a reinsurance contract held that at initial recognition are outside the boundary of the contract when facts or circumstances change over time. The submission we receive provides some examples and question whether and in what circumstances the requirement in paragraph 35 and B64 of IFRS 17 should be applied. The paper notes that the requirement in those two paragraphs of IFRS 17 are different and address different circumstances. Paragraph 35 applies to cash flows that are outside the boundary of a contract and that relate to future contracts. Paragraph B64 discusses the assessment of the practical ability of an entity to reprice a contract, considering constraints that might limit that ability, and therefore applies to the reassessment of the contract boundary in this context. The paper notes that the submission discusses circumstances that are not a reassessment of the contract boundary of an existing contract. The additional cash flows do not reflect cash flows arising from the substantive right and obligation of the existing contract, but rather relate to right and obligation of a future contract. Paragraph 35 applies in these circumstances, and these additional cash flows will be recognized as a new contract when the recognition criteria of the new group of insurance contracts are met. And finally, the paper notes that paragraph 35 should not be read as if cash flows outside the contract boundary could be within the existing contract boundary at a later reporting date, other than in the circumstances to which paragraph B64 applies. So I would like to ask the TRG members' views on the analysis in this paper.
We agree with the view when you are talking about cash flows that are outside the contract boundary for reasons of renewing, that a contract is actually ending and then may renew or may not renew. In other words, cash flows that are after the end of the contract boundary. However, we don't agree with the analysis for cash flows which, such as the exercise of an option to increase the amount of coverage on an existing contract, which was outside the original contract boundary because it was not a present substantive obligation, because you haven't made any promises or guarantees about the premium that you're going to charge. But then at the time of election, we believe that would become within the contract boundary of the existing contract. The reason we disagree with this is because it is inconsistent. It's inconsistent with the guidance on contract modifications, and in particular, paragraph 73. There's no economic difference in this situation from a contract which has no option to increase coverage and then is modified to allow the policyholder to add coverage. In that case, paragraph 73 would clearly say you're just adjusting the fulfillment cash flows of the existing contract. That's not economically different than allowing for an option to increase the coverage in the contract with no substantive obligation. And in fact, it seems almost contradictory that you would treat the election of an option within a contract as a separate new contract. But if you don't have that option, if you don't allow for that option at all, but later decide on an ad hoc basis to offer to add coverage to the person, to the policyholder, that you would treat it as a continuation or an addition of the current product. So it was a fundamental inconsistency in our view. It also seems to conflict with the previous discussion that we had on separation of insurance components within a contract. This would be, you could create that situation by just allowing for an option within the contract. You could get to that point. So there are, and then there was even somebody very clever came up with the further argument that even if you were to consider something, an addition of coverage as a separate contract, paragraph 9 would force you to combine it with the original contract anyway, because it's clearly not a separate contract in its substance. So basically, that's basically the argument. There are practical difficulties as well. We would not have the information that would allow us to treat each separate bit as this is not just increases of coverage, it would also be additions of riders to contracts with no promise on pricing. We don't have the information to allow us to separate all those bits. And there also seems to be an issue with on transition with the retrospective application of this. Would it force us to separate the contract we have now into the various bits that were added at various points in time? We don't have that concept of it's not separate contracts, and I don't believe it's right to consider it as separate contracts. To answer the question of how we saw this in the context of the words in IFRS 17, in particular, paragraph 35. Our understanding is that paragraph was written in the context of outside the contract boundary, meaning beyond the end of the contract boundary. It was always talking about renewals of contracts and whether a renewal should be a future contract or not. The idea that you might have other cash flows outside the contract boundary, but before the end of the contract boundary, would they occur because there's no substantive rights or obligations? That actually wasn't even contemplated in anything I saw until the May TRG meeting discussion. So I believe it's reasonable to make the presumption that when paragraph 35 was written, it was only talking about renewals and whether you consider a renewal a new contract or not. Another argument that has been posed is that the last sentence of paragraph B64, which is the one that says you would reassess the contract boundary given changes in substantive rights and obligations, that sentence was actually added well later than the rest of paragraph B64. It was added in February of 2017. To address a particular issue, and effectively, it was added to that paragraph to avoid having to renumber the whole standard.
I remember that it was that sentence was in the basis for conclusions and was in the basis for conclusions for forever.
Okay,
but at a late stage, reading the basis, we thought, well, that actually isn't an explanation of a requirement in the standard. That is something that should be in the standard. So we moved it from the basis into the standard. But it wasn't for any reason other than it had always been there but was in the wrong place.
Okay, fair enough. The reference to paragraph BC-164, I think on my read, it says clearly that it is just an example. It's not meant to be exhaustive. Another possible interpretation would be to say that if you have excluded an election or an option to add coverage because there's no substantive right and obligation because you can reprice or because you can set the price on that addition anew, then clearly the election of that option has changed your ability. It has become part of the substantive rights and obligations of the existing contract. We further think that the staff's concern that applying the reassessment of the contract boundary has the potential to turn short-term contracts into long-term contracts. We don't have trouble understanding why that's such a concern, because if it's a short-term contract, everything's going to be gone anyway. The cash flows will have ended. The contractual service margin will be exhausted. There would be no real difference in treating it as a new contract rather than a continuation of the existing contract, except perhaps for the locked-in discount rate, which isn't going to have much of an impact on short-term contracts anyway. So, you know, we don't think it's a problem to treat this the way that seems sensible to us and consistent with the guidance on modification. I'll stop there. There were some other points raised, which I might get to depending on the questions here. And then I do have another point that is about example three that's completely different, but I would like to hear the views of others on this viewpoint first. Thank you.
It isn't actually a modification, though, because the option was there.
The option was there at the beginning, similar to the renewal option that was there.
Kevin. The concern I have with the paper is, you know, for many months, we and others have seen that it feels like there's a conflict in the standard between paragraph 35 and B64, and that they're saying different things. And I'm not sure if you just read them, you get to your conclusion, which is it's a pretty narrow thing that we meant when we were talking about B64. So, you know, I can understand, you know, you're saying that, but I don't think you can get there just by reading the standard.
What in the words would lead you to a different place?
Well, exactly what they say, right? So if the end of paragraph 64, you know, tells you that you should reassess the contract boundary to include the effect of changes in circumstances on your substantive rights and obligations, and, you know, I guess passage of time, the change in circumstance.
Somebody electing
I guess
an option.
When reading the end of the paragraph without reading the whole context may have an impact on that, and the way that I guess we would read the requirements in the standard is paragraph 35 seems perfectly clear that cash flows that are outside the contract boundary belong to a future contract. That's really hard to argue with that. And we read paragraph 64 within that context, and the business basis for conclusion also explain why we have that. So we felt that there is no conflict there, but I get why we got the question. So this is why we have a submission and a TRG paper to discuss that.
I'd be interesting to hear if anyone else got to this conclusion before you did. So did anyone else realize this is what you meant before this paper came out?
William?
Thank you. I struggled with the conclusion drawn by the staff from reading the language. And it wasn't just 64, B64 versus 35. I think 35 is pretty clear. But 64 is telling you where you need, what you need to do to reevaluate where that contract boundary is. And once that is redetermined, any cash flows that are outside that contract boundary are out because of paragraph 35, excuse me. But if I follow through from paragraph 61 through 62, or then back to 2, the way you've laid it out here and there, in order to determine the contract boundary, I look at whether there are substantive rights and obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 62 says, as part of the estimation of that, I need to estimate, you know, evaluate whether policyholders are going to exercise the options available within the contract. Not new ones, new contracts, but available in that contract.
Within the boundary.
And then in 64, you know, I use that information to evaluate whether my substantive rights and obligations have changed with regards to those options in the contract. That, for me, establishes a new contract boundary, and then whatever cash flows are within that contract boundary are included in the measurement. So I don't then jump to your conclusion that for a renewal option or any other option that is in the existing contract, that would be automatically out because of paragraph 35.
I think it comes down to what we intended or meant or how you interpret. So in the last sentence of B64, where we talk about the effect of changes in circumstances and what we meant by changes in circumstances there. And I, you know, having had this discussion, I can see that you can't tell that we meant this very narrow change in circumstance being a change in the economic environment, in which the contract is running, rather than changes in renewal options and things. So it was intended to identify situations where you are in a sort of death spiral situation. So obligations that had seemed to have had no commercial substance were now coming into play, and that's what this was meant to address. Now, I agree, it doesn't say all of that there, but that's what that was meant to address, not the circumstances covered by paragraph 35, which is just saying that if you had put things outside your boundary, then just the fact that you, if an option to renew was outside the boundary, just the fact that you did renew doesn't mean that you've increased you've changed the boundary of the original contract. So that was the cut that we always intended, even though I agree it's, you know, the wording is not as clear as I now wish it were.
So, but I think that, just to add to Anne's point, what you just explained is how I read what we have in paragraph BC 164. This is where we actually explain what we meant in that. We, the standard, explain on the basis for conclusions for the standard requirements. So that is the missing piece that maybe people are looking for. Sorry, Sue.
I was going to say, and that and the fact that paragraph 364 is all about what does this notion of practical ability mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to answer Kevin's question. So we agree with the analysis. Before we had seen the staff paper, we had struggled with the conflict with the two paragraphs, but we thought that was what was intended, which is why when we read the staff paper, we were fine with it, because it's what we thought was intended. It's just we're struggling a bit with the B64 last sentence. So we'd seen the conflict, but we had read that we thought that was what was intended.
To Hugget's comment, does the BC help get you over the line there, or is it more just the content of the paper that gets you over the line?
Well, we'd had the BC when we had the discussion before, and we still had some people saying it didn't get me there enough. So.
Massimo?
I think that I would not with what Leslie said, and I think it's also consistent with what you said. So the fact that there is something that is out, that is not commercial substance when you assess initially the contract boundaries, and it starts having commercial substance after, for example, an option of the policy order, is for me more a redefinition of the contractual boundaries, and would be, from also an economic standpoint, prefer to be accounting for as a change of unfilmed cash flows rather than the creation of a new contract. And this is also, I guess, linked to the fact that the information about new contract is also a very relevant information for the external users. And so mixing in the same information, real new contracts, with other that are mere addition of coverage to enforce contracts would create, it's not the best information about my capability of issuing new contracts. We are missing two items that are different from an economic standpoint. And so I think that applying the rationale that is in the modification of insurance contract in the standard to this particular case, it represents better the economic substance of the transaction.
It might have been, but this is not the requirements of the standard. So I think that we are talking about different things. So one thing is contract modification. It's well defined, and it has an accounting requirements on how to do that. What is not contract modification cannot be applying the same requirements, and I think that this is nothing. This is not on the table at the moment, because we're not talking about contract modification. However, we would like to get to the same place. I think something else that is a bit of a mix-up in the discussion is mixing the examples that we have in this paper and for this discussion that talks about the extension of the coverage for an additional period, which is one thing, and the discussion that we had in May, which is adding another layer at the same time frame. And I think that May, we ended up with a discussion that we said at least the staff and some of the TRG members agreed that when you look at contract boundaries, you need to see whether you have a right to reprice the whole thing, and then the cash flows that relate to riders should go into that contract boundaries. And there was a point noted, I think, by yourself, Leslie, as maybe as others, to say, well, we might think that in our circumstances, this additional rider does not have a substantive, we don't have a substantive obligation, so we exclude it. This is not one of the examples here, although I think the same principles apply. I think it would be very good first to see what are your views on the analysis that is based on those two requirements and the examples that we received, and maybe not to mix up with that previous discussion where people ended up differently on what they think about that additional rider, whether it has a substantive obligation or not. It may create a bit of confusion, so maybe if you can address that.
I think I started off saying I agree with the examples that are the extension. And to your point, I also read what it says, and I understand what you meant, but what you meant was in the context of renewals and options to renew. You even said it yourself. And BC 164 only says, for example, I drew the conclusion that you couldn't make the same conclusion for that additional layer because to do so is inconsistent completely with the sensible guidance on modification. And I can get there through the logic that Bill and Massimo pointed out, that it really is a change in the circumstances affecting the substantive rights and obligations. So if you are willing to agree that the paper is limited to the example of renewals, I can get there.
The same for me. So I agree with the examples, but I would have problems in
because of the way we look at that extra kind of layer.
Let's hear from others. Maybe.
Francesco?
I wanted to make a comment about a conclusion that seems to be coming from paragraph 28. It's the one that we talked about earlier, that this could be turning any annual contract into a long-term contract. I just would like to check one thing. Is in the example of the reinsurance contractor that is covered in the paper, there is this 90 days right to stop coverage prospectively. Mm-hmm. Now, in a reinsurance contract, you have a boundary which is determined by the analysis of the rights and obligations, etc. But then you also have to take into account what it is that you are reinsuring. Yeah. And think about the business that could be reinsured in those 90 days. You can be reinsuring long-term assurance contracts, 30, 40 years. So although you are only capturing the expected cessions from the cedants for the next 90 days, but every one of those contracts will actually call you for a standard rate obligation for the next 30, 40 years. So that statement in its own isolation could be seen as telling us too much. That's my concern, and I wanted to make this comment so then you consider whether you want to have it in the record. But it's not necessarily the case that these could turn short-term contracts into long-term contracts, because even with a 90 days boundary, you may still have a long-term contract, and that is entirely legitimate under IFRS 17.
This is why it says it could. I can see other circumstances as well.
A much more helpful point, I think, is in this paper that says, effectively, the time dimension that IFRS 17 calls you to consider has got, at least I would say, three possible measurements, if you like. One is the boundary, which we've been spending already some time. Then we have the coverage period. And you say in the paper that they do not necessarily are the same. And that's a very important practical point for people to understand and appreciate. There is also the other one, that is the extent you are also going to settle after coverage. And that's a third dimension. Again, it can go beyond coverage, beyond boundary. And so to me, in terms of our educational mission here, I wanted to make sure that this was said, because I think that people need to understand that the boundary is not the only time dimension that you need to reflect in the measurement of the standard. paragraph 33, which is the fundamental requirement on fulfillment cash flows estimation, effectively uses the boundary for a particular point, which is you got to know when to stop including future inflows. And that's the real important thing. But then all the other cash flows need to be considered in the context of that boundary for the inflows, but then the substantive rights and obligations that go with that may actually take you to estimate cash flows well beyond the boundary because of other elements that are forming your substantive obligations. And although the paper is focusing on the boundary here, I don't want our constituents around the world to actually miss the point that the boundary is just one important element, but not the only important element to understand how to dominate effectively the time dimension in the application of IFRS 17. So I was wondering whether people would respond to an analysis of your conclusions on B64, which I would put in a different way, and that is to say there is a requirement to assess the impact of what the boundary is. That may require the practicability assessment, but it may not require that because the boundary in that particular contract is actually independent of a practicability. Think about the whole of life contract. Yet B64 would be still requiring a reassessment of the boundary in the sense to say, I have no boundary in this particular contract. I have then just to look at the expectation of my policyholders to survive for a number of periods of years because that is what will be necessary for me to execute the requirements of paragraph 33, which is the fulfillment cash flows on a current basis. We have seen that some readers of this paper were led to conclude that perhaps the staff paper was indicating that only if there is a change in practicability, you reassess, which I believe is wrong, and I believe that you didn't mean to say that, but because of the qualification on the practicability in the context of paragraph B64, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that someone is reading it in a very narrow way, and perhaps that's not what I believe, at least the staff intended. So I just wanted to dissipate that concern by making this comment to the TRG in public. I believe that the qualitative assessment is important. You need to understand what the boundary is, and then you need to drive the consequences from a measurement perspective, which go beyond the mere practical ability assessment. And that can be only done in the context of 33, which says, estimate the cash flows within the boundary. So at that point, the qualitative assessment turns into a quantitative measure of the necessary point in time within which the inflows are going to be estimated.
Do you agree with the analysis, though, taking into consideration the points you just made, which, but on the contract boundary point, do you agree with the analysis in the paper?
So I would agree that, for example, in that example of the reinsurance, the 90 days, the unilateral rights that the reinsurer has to cancel the standard rate obligation, that is the boundary. But then I have to take the consequences of what I've reinsured in those 90 days. And if I'm reinsuring 50 years contracts, then... So as long as we understand it, it's not just one thing.
Yep. Yes.
But it's important what your view is on that first.
Darren? So I was just going to say that I've heard a lot of very confusing conversations related to exactly the point that it's the rights and obligations that arise in 90 days. The cash flows as a consequence of those rights and obligations may happen far in the future, and even the simplest policy.
Yeah.
If I have a one-year motor car cover, but I might only be paid out for my damage in a year and a half's time, that cash flow is not outside of the boundary. So I think sometimes people have been thinking too linearly about what the boundary means, and I think it's probably a good point for us to try.
And reassessment of these cash flows, just to add to this point, is not reassessment of the contract boundary.
Yeah.
It's remeasurement on a current value basis, your cash flows within the same contract boundary.
Zecho?
Thank you. I just want to comment on our assessment of the three examples. Based on the fact patterns presented and our understanding of IFRS 17, we arrive at the same conclusion as in the paper for example one and example two. Yeah. For example three, the paper suggests that the new pieces that are issued 90 days later relate to a future contract. You know, so that's wasn't what we expected, but having said that, yeah, we welcome the clarification. We can live with this here.
Okay, thanks. Leslie?
This relates also to example three. I must admit I was surprised at example three, given that we have a 90-day termination rate. The example three clarifies that we don't have to project future sessions
more
in the measurement of the current liability if the right to terminate, if the period of the right to terminate is less than the reporting period. And I found that very surprising given the discussion we had in February when all of us were so fussed about that. So, and it, I also must admit I found your distinguishing the right to terminate from the right to reprice. I wasn't sure I followed that, but I must admit that I liked the results of it. But, you know, for me, when it talks about the substantive right to reprice or to reset benefits, I think the right to terminate is just a variation of that. So, but you have not. You have definitely distinguished the two.
And
So we were happy with the conclusions in the paper based on the very narrow fact set that was there, so that was fine. One of the things that came to mind was looking at the example where the commercial substance of the ability to reprice was limited to 100%, and in the first year that had no commercial substance, and subsequently it did. Yeah. So that was quite an interesting one if you're looking at PAA eligibility, and I thought it was worth bringing up for people who are in that space of looking at PA eligibility. You need to consider the products you've got, and if there's a prevalence of those types of restrictions, consider not just it looks like a 12-month contract, but could it be a slightly longer contract? And that's not necessarily going to invalidate PA eligibility, as I keep mentioning. It doesn't. It runs to 12 months or beyond if you get materially similar outcome. So it's not going to necessarily invalidate it, but it's just worth thinking about when you're doing that testing around PA eligibility. Just back to Darrell's point, just wanted to clarify, you know, if you've got a one-year motor policy, that is 1 year of coverage. The fact that underlying that and the claims might pay out for a bit longer is not going to invalidate the coverage period.
Yes.
Can I have also other voices? Because, man, we have not kind of what others think. We have some thinking, okay, it is not clear. Others think it is clear, but only limited to some. And if others could, maybe Roman, yeah.
Yeah, so I think on the concrete examples, I agree with the staff conclusions, but I share the points made by various others that the interpretation which are leading you to the result, I think in that specific fact pattern might be okay. But I also see the B64, I read not in these narrow circumstances, which say here, support by the staff also in the discussion. I know we are not discussing other fact patterns, but when I would then continue, so to say, with this narrow definition of B64, assessing a different fact pattern, I exactly arrive at the problems and issues Leslie pointed out, which would overall be not a presentation of IFRS 17 in a way we currently intend in our implementation projects. We came to different conclusions so that we had not such a narrow reading, we came to other conclusions, and actually it would somehow give a very different picture if we now would go to such a narrow interpretation. So I'm so far not taking this position, and I think I'm more convinced to read it more broadly. Yeah.
And what in the words got you there, Roman, out of interest? What in the words caused you to read it more broadly?
Yeah, I think that when reading it, I think out of the words, as I think mentioned by the colleagues, I cannot see really that this is only this specific circumstance where you have a change of the restrictions. But I think, that was for us, I think, a broader paragraph where you really can have a look on the facts and circumstances. So an option, for example, coming into play, which was outside the contract boundary initially, can be part of the contract. And I just do not really get this narrow reading out of the standard, I must say.
Despite the fact, sort of following on from the point that I think Hagit made earlier, the fact that D64, all of the lead up before that last sentence is focusing on a very particular sort of scope of circumstances, all focusing on this practical ability and when you make, how you make this assessment, and then it concludes with this one sentence. Mm-hmm. You still read that final sentence more broadly? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think that was the assumption.
It's very hard for us to write principles-based standards.
But so I have to agree with Robin, because the start of that sentence is, in determining the estimates of future cash flows at the end of the reporting period, an entity shall reassess the boundary of an insurance contract to include the effect of changes in circumstances on the entity's substantive rights and obligations. The whole discussion about practical ability is not connected logically to those words. We're talking about estimate. We're talking about substantive rights obligations. So a much more comprehensive way, yeah, is the only way, at least all of us, we've been discussing with each other, we can read those words. And when we read them, the staff paper say, oh, no, it's actually only practical ability. Now, I hope that we clarify that this is not what you meant, but this is why we have raised this concern. I'm glad to hear that it is not the case.
But we didn't say that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I'm just explaining what it is in the words that led us to make these comments.
No, yeah. That was a genuine question.
Indeed, and I'm trying to...
I couldn't have read it that
I was trying
way,
to be as helpful. Yeah.
And as I said, just to reemphasize, in my view, all of the discussion about boundary was always about only renewals. It was the only context for any of those discussions.
But where does it say renewal that in the standard?
I read the entire standard, and every discussion of the boundary is always limited to... If it's outside the contract boundary, it's beyond. It's after the end of. It's a temporal thing. It's a renewal of the coverage. That's exclusively. That's the only thing the standard or the basis for conclusions ever talks about. It doesn't contemplate the other.
So may I just confirm my understanding based on what I've heard so far, is that if we're talking about only options to extend coverage for additional period, you find the analysis sensible, the distinction between paragraph 35 and B64 makes sense to you, and this is what you would have expected. But when we added this other layer, which is another rider, which we discussed in the May meeting,
yes,
you don't feel that comfortable with reading the words or with the outcome. So the analysis works for you, makes sense for extending the period, but you don't feel the same way about additional rider, which I think we ended up similarly last time in the May TRG meeting, when people expressed different views on how they see those additional riders. I guess for us, those additional riders, if you cannot reprise the whole thing, they are in the contract boundaries. And if they happen and do not happen, it is impacting those cash flows anyway. So it's not reassessing the contract boundaries, but it goes into the measurement in the way that you would have expected. But if you would take the other turn that you mentioned last time to say, well, I don't think I have a substantive obligation for this bit at all, I guess the way that we treat it, we look at it as something that relates to a future contract, and our analysis would lead to this meaning a new contract. So I think that for extending for another period, we got a consistent understanding. So tell me if not, because I think that we only talk about those additional riders, but it's very important that we wouldn't end up this discussion just saying, for this specific example, it works, because we need to provide some helpful guidance outside. So for the extension of a period, things work.
But I'd just like to also point out that B62 yeah, refers to renewal options, surrender options, yes, conversion options, yeah, options, and it says includes, so it does imply it's all options, not just renewal options.
I agree, but that's if it's in with the boundary of the contract. I agree with you.
Like the terminating.
If the options are within the boundary of the contract, then clearly it's just a change to the fulfillment cash flows. The sole trouble for me is the bits that are part of the contract terms, because we've written them into the contract, but don't really create any present obligation, because we haven't made any promise associated with those. That's all I'm talking about. I know in May we did have the conflict about, remember the staff position was that it's only not in the contract boundary if you can reprice the whole shooting, yes, match, and I disagreed with that. And so it's still that problem that is causing the issue here.
It's the same disagreement.
If we are limited to, and I would disagree with your statement, like if you are trying to say that that's a future new contract, then I have a problem. I have to figure out what to do, because it just doesn't make any sense. And it, as I say, it's inconsistent with the guidance on modification. But and now I've lost my train of thought. Sorry. But that is the crux of it. Oh, I know what I was going to say. If you are only talking about the option to extend or renew, then in truth, the addition in BC 64 is really unnecessary. It's almost never going to happen. If that's all you were talking about, then you didn't need to add it, and it just added. But I don't think it was added for that reason. I go back and read the discussion from February, and it's more general than that.
Kevin?
I said a slightly different point. So I guess reflecting the sort of educational role of the TOG, in example 3, page 17, I thought it would be useful that in the summary if you could highlight what you've got in A16, which is basically where you're talking about this 90-day boundary, and as we've all said, there's been a lot of debate about how you treat it, and you know, is 34 or B64 in conflict. I think you make a helpful clarification here that says, you know, as a result of the fact that we say the boundary is 90 days, does it mean you get a new contract every single day as the time goes forward? And I think you clarify here that it's only when you meet the recognition criteria in paragraph 62 that you actually have a new contract. So in your example, you only have a new contract at the end of the 90 days. So I think it would be helpful if you just make that clear, because there's been a lot of views expressed, I think, in discussions about whether it's, you know, this is a one day or not. So it was really helpful clarification.
Okay, thanks. William.
I'm going to echo actually that comment Kevin had, but I also wanted to reiterate Leslie's last comment. The exercise of renewal option on almost every contract happens after the completion of the first coverage period. Effectively, you know, a minute before to pay that first premium. So I don't think that B64, that last paragraph, last sentence, was necessary in order to get the renewals out of the contract bound.
It was to get some in rather than get some out.
Yeah. But yes. I mean, to distinguish there, to worry about it distinguishing, because you wouldn't be able to exercise that option until you get to later into
the paragraph was added when we added the. So in the original ED, we had it to be assessed on an individual policyholder basis. And then when we added the, it was a practical accommodation that if you can price it at portfolio level, then you would be able to look at the practical ability to reprice the portfolio rather than the individual policyholder. Then we were worried about a situation where you might not always be able to do it, even though you could do it when you first assess it, that in the future you may not be able to reprice the portfolio. So it was added to make sure that in those situations that the contract boundary would lengthen to accommodate the fact that there may be onerous contracts in there. So it was added to include in renewals, not to exclude renewals.
Helpful. Okay. Do you think we have sufficient clarity? I don't think so, but maybe we cannot reach additional clarity.
I personally am really confused.
Yeah,
I don't know what we have agreed or not agreed.
Yeah, and I have heard, okay, that in this specific fact patterns, maybe we have majority agreeing. Mm-hmm. But there is something else, which I have not totally understood what it is. It's something where people didn't agree, but...
That's a different
fact. Fact pattern, and what I always say, okay, we...
But it's also the issue that we discussed in May.
It's the same as May, right? Yes.
So we are consistent in this, at least.
Shall I try to summarize and then you add if I miss anything? So thinking about the purpose of the paper, I think that I heard that the analysis is helpful to clarify the possible conflict between paragraph 35 and paragraph B64 when those paragraphs are read in isolation and not in the context of the guidance where they are included. So in addition, I remember that you said it is important to then consider the wider implication of these analyses, considering the other requirement in the standard, for example, when you compare accounting with the requirement for contract modification, so situation that might have interaction. And when clarifying the accounting, when paragraph 35 applies, so when a new contract is accounted for, it's important to remember that the new contract is accounted for in the financial statement only when the recognition criteria are met.
I'm not sure what that second point means.
No, me neither.
It sounds awfully general.
Yeah. So can I try just to reiterate the second point? Did you want to try?
No,
okay. I'll have a go. I think that the second point is that it seems like TRG members are supportive of the analysis or the distinguishment between paragraph 35 and paragraph B64 when they think about an extension of a contract to additional periods. TRG members have different views on applying those this distinction when they think about adding an additional rider to an existing contract, which is consistent with where they ended up. We ended up in the May discussion. People thought differently about additional rider, whether it has substantive obligation or not. I think it's more or less. Do you want to add?
I was going to say. I think the problem is that we've got a contradiction here in that. Essentially, some people would have said in May, and I think Leslie's example in May is, they said that a particular condition or particular option in the contract is not really part of the contract.
Yes.
And now we seem to be saying it's not really part of the contract until it's part of the contract, and then it was always part of the contract.
Yeah.
And so, I think that's the contradiction that we're dealing with.
And I think that this is not something that
I don't think it's a problem if you recognize the existence of the option at the first instance. It's only if you don't recognize the existence of the option and then you realize the option is exercised, so then it somehow.
So it's only limited to those circumstances that you think that you don't have substantive obligation with respect to that rider, which we talked about in the May meeting. So we will try to pull this up into a helpful summary. Okay.
You have two, but. Do you add to the summary or to the confusion?
No pressure.
Both.
I read it as the change in circumstances relates to a substantive obligation, as to whether you include it in the measurement or not. So that it would have had to have been there. And if there's a change in circumstances which change the measurement of that substantive obligation, that's when you would amend your contract boundary. But it's something that would have had to been in the contract to start with. A circumstances has changed, which changes your measurement of that component. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think that you're trying to say, and I think that's what I think the standard did already say.
Okay, thanks for that. Sorry, didn't want it to. Okay, then I think we go to the...
Do you want to take one of the agenda items?
Yeah, go to the next point. I think I would suggest we take the first one, and after that we will close for the day and then do the rest of the four tomorrow. Okay. That is fine, yeah?
Change again
the seats, right?
Agenda paper seat?
Yeah.
We can give them a moment. Yeah, maybe they want to grab their papers or something.
Yes.
Could be. Well, let's see how long it takes.
Yeah.
Okay, Laura. No, no.